This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, Lendon Gray reflects on her partnership with Seldom Seen as part of our American Dressage Legends series. And California-based rider Jan Aberling shares his experiences of being a demo rider at the Adequan USDF FEI Level Trainers Conference West. And finally, on the program, we will have a tip from Emmy Johnson on correct halts and rein back. But first, we have one item of news as we celebrate the success of Team USA, who got off to a flying start in the first official FEI Nations Cup dressage competition, which took place in Wellington, Florida. The team, which comprised of Vidardis, ridden by Laura Graves, Shelley Francis aboard Doctor, Woodstock, ridden by Arlene Page, and Casey Perry Glass, riding Gertlingard's Doublet. They finished 25 points ahead of the field of six teams. In runner-up was Canada, also an all-women team, with Spain third and then Denmark fourth and Costa Rica fifth, finally Australia bringing up the rear end. Series now continues into Odense, Denmark and Compiègne in France next month, and then they go on to Rotterdam in the Netherlands in June and Falsterbo in Sweden, Aachen in Germany, and then finally the series wraps up in Hickstead in England in July. Now we continue our series of the American Dressage Legends in conversation with Lendon Gray, who shares her partnership with the 2005 Rumor Foundation USDF Hall of Fame inductee, Seldom Seen. And Lendon joins us now to talk about that once-in-a-lifetime partner. Lendon, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Love being here.
Well, I know we have had this conversation before about this famous combination, this partnership, which was, as I said, once in a lifetime. I mean, do you often get asked about him now?
Oh, he's the one of all of my horses. He's the one that people still talk about. I still have people come up to me and say, you know, they saw me competing on him somewhere and it gave them a boost because he was just a little normal horse competing against the best in the country. And, you know, at a time when people were importing big and fancy and impressive European horses, and he proved that you could still do something really well on a very average little horse.
He strikes me as a kind of horse that had a sense of self-importance, that he knew that the attention was on him.
He loved the attention. And the more people, the more noise, the more distractions that bothered other horses, the more he puffed himself up and just gave his all.
So the temperament was ideal then for dressage, would you say, Lendon?
The temperament was ideal for me at that moment in my career. He was the first horse that I trained completely from basically beginning to, you know, through a long Grand Prix career. And he was very forgiving when I made mistakes and would discover them and would kind of go back and have to redo things. You could almost hear him go, okay, how do you want me to do it now? He was a little, to be a really super duper Grand Prix horse, he was a little laid back. He was a little lazy. But as I say it, for the point of my career, he was absolutely perfect.
How did you meet?
I was working a few years after college. I went to work for Peggy Whitehurst in Alabama. Peggy was an amazing woman who developed dressage and eventing in Pony Club in the South and did a tremendous amount for that world. She owned broodmares, Thoroughbred and Connemara. And Seldom Seen was a little horse that she had raised originally for her daughter, Kim. And then when Kim wasn't riding so much, Peggy herself rode him. He was, you know, barely 14-3. And so I was sort of teaching Peggy on him to event. And we went to an event where she got the flu. And so she said, we're entered, why don't you ride him? And he was 5 years old at the time. This was, you know, like novice, baby novice something. And I rode him, and we won, and she thought that was pretty cool, and that was the beginning. And he evented very successfully that year, but she felt he was too small to really go on in the event, you know, big-time event world. She had some big-time eventers. So she said, why don't you do some dressage? And every level I got to, I thought, well, this is as far as we're going to go. But we just kept going.
What were your impressions of him when you first rode him?
Oh, I thought he was fun. You know, he was just a cool little guy. He was just, you know, game. He was a good jumper. He was willing to do anything. But, you know, I had absolutely no delusions of grandeur. I mean, he was just fun. And it was really Mike Poulin. Well, as Seldom Seen continued up the ladder, so to speak, I got more and more negativity from the big time people. And at that point, I was starting to train with Mike Poulin, and he was the one that, you know, the more people said you shouldn't be doing this and this will ruin your career and he doesn't belong in the big time, the more Mike said, oh, yeah, we're going to show him. And so it was with his hand at my back, kind of pushing me along and also giving me the instruction to train a Grand Prix horse. We brought him out every level. He did well.
And you mentioned he could jump, of course, being a Connemara, he would be able to pop. He'd probably be able to take you fox hunting all day as well. Was that not a temptation to you, or at that time in your career had you decided it was only going to be dressage for you in terms of performance and competition?
Well, he came into my life as I was starting to specialize in dressage. So there was really, that was the only direction we would have gone in. But he would have probably been a wonderful fox hunter.
Absolutely. In terms of you putting it in perspective into your riding career, what did that mean at that time? And then when you look back at it now, how would you contextualize the success of that partnership you had with him, Lyndon?
Well, he came into my life as just at the beginning of my international career. I had started riding him and then acquired Beppo, who took me to the World Championships and 1980 Olympic team, and then later on, came into my life, and he was my second Olympic horse, and it was while I was showing him, mostly, that I was also showing Seldom Seen Grand Prix. So I was showing them often competing against ourselves. And even though, you know, I'd made two Olympic teams and competed internationally and won lots of national championships on lots of different horses, Seldom Seen was the one that helped me make a name. I mean, it was Seldom Seen that people knew more than anything else. And again, it was Seldom Seen that brought me to where I am now, which is working a lot with kids and ponies, you know, trying to promote ponies and working with kids. And it was truly because of him, because I had he was known as the pony. He legally wasn't a pony, but he was known as the pony. And when people started riding ponies and had questions, they contacted me because I was the one that rode the pony. And that kind of got me going in the pony direction. And when you're working with ponies, you start working with kids. And that's what started me going in the direction of working so much with young people. I mean, I can lay the blame right at his feet. he was the beginning of a long road, but when it came to the division of the road, what direction in which I was going to go, Seldom Seen directed me to where I am now.
So you always had a soft spot for ponies then because of him, but
yes.
How did he get his name?
He got his name because when he was born, Peggy owned the mare, and it's actually kind of a cute story. She sent her Connemara mare to a farm to be bred to a Connemara stallion, and the mare would have absolutely nothing to do with the stallion, and it was a total lack of success. Of course, this was back in the days when all the breeding was live cover. And she was about to bring him home, and she said, is there anything else you can breed her to? And the farm had a New Zealand thoroughbred who was their teaser. So they turned the mare out with this teaser, and sure enough, she came home in foal, and they thought the teaser was infertile.
Usually the case.
He wasn't. So that was where, you know, he was out of a Connemara mare and by this New Zealand thoroughbred stallion. But when he was born, he was so tiny, she said that you could seldom see him above the weeds in the pasture. So that's where the seldom seen came from. And it was the beginning of all of her Connemara and Connemara crosses that she bred ended up with seen in their name in some way. My second wonderful little Grand Prix horse was Last Seen. He was actually the last of them that she bred. Sort of came full circle.
You mentioned that he was right for you at the time. What was that chemistry, Lyndon?
Well, I just mentioned Last Seen, who was the second of the pony-sized Grand Prix horses that I had. And I've always said I was so lucky to have them in that order, because Last Seen was hot, a little bit temperamental, a little bit difficult, and not very forgiving. And if he had been the first one I tried to train to Grand Prix, it probably would have been a disaster. But by then I had a whole lot more experience. Seldom Seen, just, you know, he was so easygoing and he was so straightforward to train. And as I say, very forgiving when I made mistakes, he helped me to be successful. He took me by the hand and said, you know, let me help you do this. Last Scene would have been not nearly so polite. He probably would have given me the finger if he had fingers.
So how did his temperament then, his personality, influence what you were looking for in a horse after you know that relationship had been so successful? Were you drawn towards Connemaras, or was there a type of horse that you were looking for because of that success?
Well, I never went looking for horses, to be honest. Horses came into my life. In my entire career, I went looking for a horse once, and that wasn't totally successful. But I certainly learned to be very determined in encouraging people to have the horse that fits their temperament, and to have the horse that may not be the most impressive to begin with. You know, when you're jogging it in hand and you're putting it on the lunge, or even when you're on its back as a younger horse, trainability is by far the most important thing. And the another thing that is, he was made so apparent, as do many horses now, the trot, which attracts so many people. Ooh, look at that fabulous trot. The trot is the gait you can improve. The trot that Seldom Seen had in the show ring didn't relate in any way to his natural trot. It was a trained trot. It was a developed trot over years of strengthening and suppling. The canter is the gait you can't improve so much. And no matter how much we tried to sort of develop his canter more, yeah, we made a little inroad, but not much. So the basic good quality gaits, not necessarily one highly impressive gaits, and the temperament is by far what's important.
When you look at your career highlights of that partnership, what would you say would be your top three, Lyndon?
The national champions, the Insilco National Championships that were in Kansas City. This was a head-to-head. This was, you know, one of the very early head-to-head championships. He came as a little bit of an underdog, but he ended up winning the whole thing. And everyone just appreciated him. We had a formal dinner where they gave the awards, and, you know, the mayor and the head of the Chamber of Commerce, and I don't know who all spoke, and somehow they all brought seldom seen into their, you know, the word seldom seen into their speech. But it was just, you know, it was an indoor head-to-head competition that the likes of which we didn't have in any way at that time. And I think the second, the part, you know, the thing that comes to mind when I think of him more than anything else is the retirement ceremony I did with him at Devon. It was actually a year after he stopped competing. We had, Peggy and I had made the decision to, we didn't ever want him to compete where people would go, oh, don't worry about him, he's over the hill. So we stopped competing him when he was 17. He won at Devon. He was overall champion at his last show up here in Connecticut. And then the following year, he spent the rest of his life just hacking, just hanging out. And the following year, I did a performance at Devon retirement. And again, so often retirement ceremonies are, you know, some sort of not terribly sound horses led in the ring and they talk about it and, you know, everybody cries and it's nice. But seldom seen was still, you know, sound and healthy and able to go. So I kind of dragged him out of his hacking life and put him together for a few weeks and did a little story performance with him, and then rode his last freestyle. And when you look at that, you can find it on YouTube, actually. His very last Piaf, it's like he knew it was his very last Piaf. He was Piafing along, doing very nicely, and all of a sudden he just powered into this tremendous Piaf like he knew this is it. And that was my most memorable time with him of all the things that we did, which included competing in Europe. I took him to Europe because we had so much negativity from the what was then the USET, the National Federation, and the people of the National Federation. I mean, it really was extremely unpleasant. And so Peggy and I raised funds we took him to Europe because everybody said he could never hold up against the Europeans. And we did hold up our own in Europe, let me put it that way. I got higher scores than I did in the U.S. And he hung in there and did very well. So that would be the third part, was our trip to Europe.
And what age did he live to? How did his end come about?
He was, I think, 24. When he was 9, he foundered very badly from travel. I took him to Virginia, and right after that trip, he was a very nervous traveler. He foundered quite badly. We were fortunate to be close to an excellent vet clinic in Charlottesville, and Peggy did absolutely everything, and he came out of it fine. But interestingly enough, when he was about 24, he was living with friends in Florida, just, you know, little trail riding and hanging out. He started to have some severe foot trouble, which probably related back to that founder, although we never had any problem with him, you know, during his competitive career. He had a year off when he foundered. That was sort of between his third and fourth level year. So he had to be put down. I think he was 24, as I remember.
So what do you say to young girls then that might ask about him now, and when they were looking for a pony? Do you recommend looking for a Connemara now and finding another seldom seen?
I recommend looking for that temperament. That's, as I said before, that's the number one thing. And not to be, you know, not to let temperament be overshadowed by fancy movement, which is sometimes the case. Even now with real ponies, you know, we have an influx of European dressage ponies, and some of them are fabulous, but some of them are difficult to ride. And number one is rideability and temperament. And you can, you know, with good training, you can really make something that doesn't look so impressive in the beginning into something very, very impressive if you're willing to take the time and do it correctly.
and a partnership with which you'll always be associated, Lyndon, I'm sure very proudly.
Ah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, sure, going to the Olympics was great and all of that part of it, but it was my career with Seldom Seen that is what I'm proud of, really, really proud of.
Well, thank you for sharing your memories of him with us here on the USDF podcast. We really appreciate it and for taking the time to come on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And now, as we continue our reviews of the 2016 Adequan USDF FEI Level Trainers Conferences, we hear from Jan Abeling, who was a demo rider at this year's conference on the West Coast with Stephen Clark. Welcome to the program, Jan.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be on it.
Well, let's talk about your experience with Stephen before you joined the Trainers Conference. Had you ridden with him before? You've ridden in front of him. I just wondered if you'd done a trainers conference, this type of thing, out of competition with him.
Not with him.
Okay.
No, not with him. Not with him. I've done some trainers conferences with other judges before in the past, but with different horses. Yeah, but that was the first time with him.
Right. As you say, you've ridden in front of him in the competition arena many times, so you were familiar with his style and his experience, of course, and his reputation. But tell us a little bit about the horse you chose to ride in front of him, Jan.
Well, I actually chose two horses. That both horses were competing the days before at a horse show. So going through 2 days of a trainers conference was a bit much, and so I decided to take one day and then the other day. One is a horse, is a stallion that I've been competing lately at Grand Prix, Rossellini. He's a stallion that's sort of my new Grand Prix horse after we had retired Rafalka. And the other one is a gelding darling that is owned by Anne Romney that I'm competing for the owner to get the horse some experience. So I chose those two horses because they were Grand Prix horses. And I really wanted the input from a top judge, who's not just a judge, but who's also been a very successful rider. And I think that sometimes what we riders criticize on judges, that we feel that sometimes they're judging us, but they don't really have so much experience riding and training horses. And that, of course, is not the case at all with Stephen.
So give us an idea of what your best performances were with these horses before the conference, Jan, so we can put this in perspective. Where were they and what did you feel that you needed to work on?
Well, Rossellini, I've competed at Grand Prix for a couple of seasons now, and he has many really strong points. His canter work is really strong. And in the trot work, the Piaf and the Passage is still a challenge. He tries too hard. He's one of those horses that is really doing way too much, and that creates sometimes a bit of a challenge to get him to do less. And so Stephen picked up on that right away, and so he gave me a couple of exercises and he things that I've been working on anyhow. And what I do in competition, I've always allowed him to kind of go a little bit forward in the Piaf, because I always felt that really would give the horse confidence. And Stephen felt very much the same way and encouraged me to not change that really a whole lot at this point, to go at the horse's pace. And he felt that the horse will get there at some point, and you know, you have to go at the horse's pace. I think that was sort of the message. Don't try to force it.
Right. So in over the 2 days of the conference, then, what did you feel you took away with each of those horses?
Well, I mean, going in, of course, I knew where the weaknesses of the horses were, and I was kind of hoping that we would have a little bit of time to spend on those weaknesses, which we did. The second horse, the gelding that I rode, has quite a nice Piaf. It's sort of the opposite and has some weaknesses in the pirouettes. And so we focused with him on the pirouettes, and he gave me some exercises, again, stuff that I've been working on already, but just it was nice to have the input from another person yes, what you're doing is right. You're on the right path. And here, why don't you try this at a different spot and try it here, try it like this, try it. So, and so it's always nice to get the input. And, you know, I think the important thing is that you always have to remember, I think in anything in life, you never get there 100%. There's always more to learn. And I think as long as you're open to learning and educating yourself, you can always get better in whatever you do.
What did you most enjoy about the experience of riding as a demo rider for Stephen, Jan?
Well, Stephen is a very, he has a very great sense of humor. He is also a person that I mean, being a really good judge, he picks up on your strengths instantly, and he picks up on your weaknesses instantly, and he's in a very positive way working with you. So I thought that was really wonderful to have him point out the weaknesses in a super positive way and tell you as a rider, but also tell the audience, look, you know, I mean, here we want to improve this, but here are the ways how we can do this, and let's see if that works. And then, you know, one or two exercises, you could see an improvement in the horse. So it was overall, it was throughout a very, very positive experience, I think, for everybody, for horse and rider, and for the audience.
And so what little exercises did he give you with both of your horses to focus on, Jan, that you found?
For the gelding with the pirouettes, for example, like quarter pirouettes, just two steps, even less than a quarter pirouette coming out of the shoulder four, and really using inner leg outside rein for turning, one, two, and then straight out and collecting again, shoulder four, and then again, one, two, turn. And we did a whole bunch of those. I didn't count them, but we probably did, I would say, 10 of those quarter turns with a walk break, and then again a few. And then he said, okay, now let's just see what happens with a full pirouette. And the full pirouette that we did after that was much, much better.
And have you shown those two horses since the conference, Jan, and applied that?
Yes. In fact, I showed I showed both horses this weekend. Before the conference, we spent some time in Florida, and so I just showed these two horses last week here in California, in San Juan Capistrano at the show, and don't you know, my pirouettes were much better, and so was my piaf, actually. Yeah.
Good. So some important takeaways then from the trainers' conference.
Yes, I think it was a very positive, very positive, and I feel like I got feedback from a judge's eye who understands to ride and train that was right on.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and sharing your experiences, and the very best of luck with both of those Grand Prix horses.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And just for anyone who cares to know, I mean, we did retire Rafaka. And Rossellini, of course, is now sort of the one that has to step up. I have a few other young ones that are very exciting. But the most exciting thing is we're starting a little bit of a new step into a sort of a new career here at the Acres, at my ranch and my wife's ranch. We have Rafaka, who is bred. She's going to be due in approximately 4 to 5 weeks. And so we're super excited to have sort of the American dream baby coming, you know? So
so the legacy continues.
The legacy continues. I mean, and as you know, with breeding, you never know. But, I mean, we're very excited. She's, of course, big as a house, and she loves her time in the field. We've been very likely riding her up until about maybe 5 weeks ago, and which when she told us, okay, this is now enough, no more saddle. So we're very, very excited.
Well, hopefully she'll look forward to motherhood as well.
Yes, she's bred to a wonderful stallion connoisseur who's a connemore. I can't wait.
Wonderful. Congratulations with that. Thank you again, Jan, for taking the time to come on the program.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. Take care.
And in our education segment this week, USDF certified instructor and bronze medalist M. Johnson is here to share a tip on correct halts and rein back. Hi, Emmy. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Where would you like to start?
So we'll start thinking about the halt and why you do these movements. And so they're introduced at second level, where you first see other collective movements, as well as the halt and the rein back. And it's a movement that's found from second level all the way up through the Grand Prix. So if you watch a Grand Prix test, you'll see the horse and rider do a halt and rein back, just like you would in a second level test. I mean, obviously at a higher degree of difficulty, but it's the same basic movement. So with the halt, you want to think that it's going to help your horse improve bending of the joints of the hind leg. So the stifle and the halt and the fetlock are all going to be asked to bend more, thus improving engagement of the horse. And it also will test the horse's balance, suppleness, and throughness. If you look in the box on your chest where it talks about what the judges are looking for in the halt, it needs to be straight, and front legs lined up, immobile, have the weight evenly distributed over all four legs, and the horse should remain attentive and on the bit, but be ready to move off at the rider's aid. So as you're riding and you're preparing to ask for a halt, you want to think that your feet and legs drive the horse forward to engage the hind legs, as the reins in the back restrain the forward motion and ask for the halt. And you want to make sure once you halted, you don't continue applying those aids, that you release your leg, seat, and rein aids, but make sure you remain straight in the saddle with those seat bones evenly weighted. And especially if you practice this movement, make sure you keep a light contact with your calves to prevent the horse from prematurely backing up if they were to think that, oh, we're getting ready to do a rein back, and maintain light contact with the bit. Some problems that you might run into with just the halt portion of this movement, if you have too much of a prolonged rein aid, if you are too strong or you don't release soon enough, the hind legs will be restricted and will become difficult for them to engage and step under the horse, and so the horse will become on the forehand and they be out behind and you won't have a square, good quality halt. There are also some other rider position faults that can contribute to problems with the halt. You want to make sure, like I said, that you're balanced in your seat, that you're not leaning forward with low hands, because then the horse might be on the forehand. So then if you were to lean backwards and have hands that were too high, that might restrict the horse's hind legs so that, again, they could not come correctly underneath the horse for the halt. If your horse starts to anticipate, you might be repeating the halt too often at the same spot. You know, usually in the test, the halts are at A or C or X. And if you practice them only at those spots, your horse might start to anticipate it and either halt prematurely or break into the walk because they know the halt is coming. So it's good to practice at different spots in the ring. If your horse is not immobile in the halt, if they want to move around or dance around, first, again, check in with yourself. Make sure that you're breathing, that you've released the aids, that you're transmitting a sense of calm and quiet to the horse. And sometimes you just have to wait it out, just sit there and breathe and help the horse try to relax. If the horse really is too antsy, go ahead and walk forward a few steps and try again. And it's always nice to have treats as a reward, so when the horse does give you a good halt, you can reward them. Also, something that I found helpful with some of the young horses that I've worked with is to practice the halts at the end of the ride, because first of all, they're probably a little tired by then, and so will appreciate the halt maybe a little more than if you tried to do it at the beginning. And also, that allows you, when you get a really nice halt that you're happy with, to dismount, and that's the reward for the horse, to teach them that halting can be a nice thing. If the horse is not on the bit in the halt, you can keep soft calf pressure with both legs, not squeezing, just light pressure, and then gently feel one side of the bit and then the other. And I like to think of it kind of as softening one hand and then finding the connection and softening the other and finding the connection, instead of just pulling backwards on the horse's mouth. And if the horse is either not square behind or wanting to swing one way or the other with the hindquarters, it usually is a rider leg aid problem, that they're stronger or weaker with one leg. So make sure going into the halt that you're really even through both legs, and you can apply your leg aid in the halt until the horse steps that leg forward. So that's the halt, and then you would go from the halt into a rein back. That's a two-beat movement. The horse is moving backwards, moving the legs in diagonal pairs, and there's no moment of suspension. Like in the trot, it's also a two-beat gait, but there is a moment of suspension. But in the rein back, one pair of legs is set down before the other is lifted. And this movement, the rein back, also, as well as the halt, develops and tests suppleness and throughness of the aids, and it asks for even more bending of the joints in the hind legs as the horse moves backwards, so it develops engagement and collection. And again, what you're looking for in the rein back is that the horse remains on the bit, that they move willingly backwards, that they move on a straight line, and that there's a correct number of steps, which would be specified. So, you know, make sure that your horse doesn't do more or less, and that there's a clear rhythm, that the diagonal legs are moving as a pair. They're not moving one front leg and then one hind leg, that they're clearly two-beat rhythm, and that the feet are well raised, that they're not dragging in the arena footing. So to ask for the rein back, you want to start from a correct halt. So good to practice, that is halt. And then you want to think that you use your feet and leg as if you're going to send the horse forward. Even think of maybe lightening your feet a little bit. Your lower legs will come slightly back to guard the hindquarters from moving sideways. And as you feel the horse start to think of moving forward, use the reins in an asking, you know, squeezing manner for the horse to yield and move backwards instead. And you want to make sure you release or lighten your aids as soon as the horse yields to them. So as you're working on the rein back, it's a good idea to practice this on the rail or against something where you can really make sure that you're straight, some visual or physical barrier that will help with the straightness. Since moving backwards requires that the horse has a lot of confidence in the rider, they're moving backwards, they can't see as well behind them. So you want to make sure that your horse trusts you, and you can work on this if your horse either has a problem with it or perhaps you're working with a young horse, by introducing this movement from the ground using your voice aids, saying back or something like that that's very clear to the horse what you're asking for with your voice, and then tapping on their chest with either your hand or the butt end of the whip. And then from teaching them on the ground, then you can have a, when you go to do it under saddle, have a ground person that would apply similar aids from the ground at first as you ask from the saddle to help the horse understand what you're asking for. And one important thing you want to keep in mind is that in the rein back, you don't want to think of it as pulling the horse backwards with the reins. It's, you're asking the horse to step backwards, but you're not pulling backwards on the bit per se. So once you've practiced it at home and you feel good about it, when you go to ride it in the test, there's some things you can think about it both as you're practicing and as you're actually riding in the show arena. And you want to make sure that the quality trot that you have before the halt is good, that, you know, it's balanced, that you are giving some preparatory half halts to let your horse know that something new, something is going to happen. You can think slightly shoulder forward to prepare to make sure your horse is straight. And then you want to make sure that you're, first of all, that you're accurate, that your halt is at the marker, that the horse's shoulder or the rider's leg should be at the letter. And then, and this is hard when you're showing, but you need to breathe and make sure you halt for at least 3 seconds. That's what it says in the USCS rule book. So, which is a lot longer than you think when you're in a show ring. And then you want to count, when you ask for the rein back, you want to count the steps of each foreleg moves next. So right foreleg, left foreleg, right foreleg, left foreleg would be four steps. And then after the rein back, the horse either needs to show a square halt or immediately move forward into the indicated gait. And again, you want to work on all of the things at home so that your horse does not anticipate the rein back, and that you have a steady connection during this movement, and that you make sure that your horse is straight. So as you're practicing, you want to think that you can be picky like this with all of your down transitions, that you prepare for them with half halts, that you make sure your horse is straight, that you're very clear with your aid, so that any down transition, not just to a halt, is preparation for this movement. You can practice your halts and rein backs at different spots in the arena, like I said, so your horse doesn't anticipate it in the test. And you can also, to help with the anticipation, is you can practice preparing as if you're going to halt, but then not actually ride the halt, ride forward out of the slightly more collected trot that you've probably gotten in to prepare for it. Another thing to think about, especially this time of year where it's winter and cold in many parts of the country, is if, or if you're hazy having your horse, if for any reason you're only allowed to do walk work, it's a really good opportunity to practice the walk, halt, walk transitions and practice making sure your horse can halt squarely with all four feet underneath him. I had to spend several months just doing that with my horse because of a injury, and I think it definitely improved the halt in our pain. Because a halt is a movement that, you know, any horse can do well. It doesn't have to, you know, a horse with, you know, maybe less flashy or less quality natural gaits can do a halt just as well as a horse that's out there doing the Grand Prix. Another thing to keep in mind is that since much of a dressage test is symmetrical, you do something right rein, you do something on the left rein. The same thing, that the halt and rein back is kind of a little special part of the test that doesn't have a partner. And so sometimes it's easy to forget that because you're going along and you think, okay, I did it on the right rein, now I'm going to do it on the left rein. And then you forget that you have to do the halt and rein back in the middle of it. So it's a good idea to practice the preceding and following movements around the halt and rein back so you get used to riding the combination. And I also found that when I'm test riding, is I always want to make sure to ride a few halts and rein backs in the warm-up just to kind of mentally and physically remind myself that in the show ring, I need to be able to, and I need to remember, to ride that movement. So, you know, it's a very beneficial movement for the horse to test their suppleness and the communication with the rider and their trust in the rider and work on collection and engagement. And so I hope that these tips help everyone to have better riding and improve their horses.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed, Emmy, for our tip this week.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
And as always, you can find much more educational resources and information on the website's eTrack. Just go to usdf.org and click on the link to the USDF's Online Learning Center. Don't forget to check out our social media channels, including Facebook and Twitter, to keep up with all the latest news and the new USDF Connection app. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.